This is Puanami Harvey, Shard of the Dreaded Feminine, April 25th, 1991.
Hi, everybody. Can you hear me in the back of the room now? My name's Kate Millard, and I'm one of the two people on the program committee for the Jung Society, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this event tonight. It's a particularly pleasurable event for me, as our speaker and I were housemates in Switzerland when we both were attending the Jung Institute. One of the things that I've heard many times since we planned this program in October from various people who had gotten the newsletter was, what's her name? How do you say it? Pua what? So I decided to introduce our speaker by telling you very briefly the story of her name, which is Puanani. Puanani was born in Hawaii. When she was three, she had polio. And this was a bit before the polio vaccine had been invented. And as that young child, she was not able to walk. And after maybe a few months, her mother, in desperation, took her to see a Hawaiian shaman, a kahuna, and he healed her, and she walked. And he also named her, and he named her Pua, which means flower, and Nani, which means beautiful. Now everyone knows, and I'm very glad. Pui was in California studying at the University of California in Berkeley. She has a degree in social and clinical psychology. She has two lovely children who are now grown. When they were in their early teens, Pui started a school in California, and around this experience, she wrote her doctoral dissertation, and not too long after that time, she made the journey across the Great Waters to Switzerland, where she was for 6 years studying at the Institute. And now she has been back in the States for a couple of years, and she is an analyst working in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm very pleased to have her here tonight to talk about a subject which was always not too far from our consciousness in that house in Zurich, the dreaded feminine. So I welcome Dr. Harvey Puanani.
Thanks, Kate. Just a little bit ago, when we were standing at the back of the room, I heard Kate introducing one of our colleagues, Kimbrough, to somebody. She said, I'd like you to meet Pui Harvey. And I so enjoyed seeing Kate referring to somebody else as Pui Harvey, and I got to stand there and think, what is that name like? What does that name even mean? And of course, she did, for the moment, had made a mistake, but it gave me a chance to hear how peculiar it must sound. And I really appreciate Kate for bridging me to you by explaining this crazy name that I've carried now for many, many decades. And I am called Pui for short because it's a lot easier than Puanani. And some people then say, well, what is your real name? And if you were really interested, you see that on my birth certificate it says Clara May. And somehow, just the journey with my name has taken me, I think, into Jungian analysis. And now brings me here to talk with you about something that I've had a great interest in for many, many years. As Kate said, I was born and raised in Hawaii. And as many of you know, there is a great goddess in Hawaii, the goddess Pele. And it was quite an experience having Pele be as the ruling matriarch in our family. I heard many, many stories about her. I heard many do's and don'ts about her, and very few of them made any sense to me. I never understood why we never drove over the Pulley at midnight with pork in our back seat. I still don't know. But it was a way of thinking that haunted me. It was as if there is something that I need to know about pleasing or staying on the good side of the goddess Pele. Then I would hear that she was angry, and over on the big island, all hell was breaking loose. And literally, she scared the hell out of people. At the same time that local people are very inspired by her and very attracted to her. So the goddess Pele has been with me a long, long while. When I came to Zurich, which was in 84, there are many things that are asked of us, and one of them for me was to prepare for an exam in religion. And we are able to choose our topic. And the one I chose was something called feminine wisdom. And I didn't even know what that meant. You know, I was just attracted to what might this look like. I knew about Sophia. I had studied a great deal, been inspired by a great deal of the research done on her, and I wanted to know more. In that process, I got attracted to a few of the Greek goddesses. And I was very surprised to find in Barbara Walker's book, that perhaps some of you know, the Encyclopedia of Women's Myths and Secrets. If you look up under Medea, or Medusa, or Metis, or Demeter, she will tell you that M-E, the names that begin with M-E or have M-E in them, are linked for her to Babylonian language, and there it's connected with feminine wisdom. She also links it to Sanskrit, where again we encounter as linked to feminine wisdom. And I found myself thinking, what if Metis, Medea, Medusa, Demeter, these kind of figures got to do with feminine wisdom? And so a long journey began, a journey that is still carrying me into its mysteries. I talk about these figures as the dreaded feminine, and intentionally, not in the sense of the negative feminine, not in the sense of the negative mother. I think the positive mother, the negative mother, get an awful lot of press. We know an awful lot about how terrified we are of the negative mother and want to stay out of her clutches, and how much we've all met her. But I came to think about something that is more integrative, even more powerful than the split-off part that we call the negative. And the term I used was dread. And if you look at the word dread, you will see that it carries the aspects of fear. Anything we dread is usually something we don't want to have to face. It will make some demand on us. It will ask something of us that we don't want to have to give. But if you look deeper into the word dread, you'll see that there's an ancient meaning that has to do with awe and reverence. And if you read spiritual texts, often you will hear about the dreaded God, or the dreaded aspect of God, or the dreaded aspects of the goddess. And that's what we'll be looking at a little bit tonight, are what are these that carry for us both fear and awe. And what I like about them is they force us to look at how we split, how we want to create something that's good or something that's bad, or something that's positive or something that's negative. And the dreaded makes us bring a little bit closer together and see that something can be both good and bad, positive and negative, not just good.
If you have any burning questions as we're talking, just raise your hand, and just so that makes a little sense as we begin. In our Western tradition, particularly in our Western religious traditions, we haven't had as many negative or, now I'm going to contradict myself, dreaded feminine figures as we might find if we look in the East. And here I'm thinking of figures like maybe some of you know Kali, the great Kali in the Hindu tradition. And I'm sorry that I don't have any images of her tonight. I was hoping to bring some with me, but I didn't get a chance to do that. But in the Hindu tradition, Kali carries a lot of what we'll be talking about. She's a dreaded goddess. She will destroy, and she will also create. And we like to think she destroys that which needs to be destroyed. We in the West lack for that image of the powerful feminine. We so long to make the feminine good and nurturing and soft and receptive and protective. But I think we forget that the feminine can also be very destructive, very demanding, very severe, very stern, very unforgiving, very, very demanding. And therein is some of its power of encountering it, is it makes demands on us. It doesn't let us be what that should be as little children, which is a very important place to have access to. It also makes us stand forth in who we are and stand up to this threat. You with me so far?
Okay. Some of you may know of Lilith in the Hebraic tradition, the Judaic tradition. We're hearing a little bit more about her now. She who, by the Talmudic tradition, was Adam's first wife. And it's kind of an interesting story that it seems to be that back then, Lilith and Adam came together somewhat as, let's say, more equals. And it is said in the ribald tradition that came time one night for lovemaking, and Lilith very much liked to be in the superior position, and that was not to be allowed. And Adam was infuriated with her and apparently goes to Yahweh and complains. Anyway, a great brouhaha breaks out, and Lilith is cast out into exile. And she becomes the child-killing, devouring creature that every so often you will see in the Old and New Testaments. Sometimes she's disguised as a screech owl, but you will see that she's in there in a subtle way, somewhat like Sophia starts to disappear through our Old and New Testaments. Well, let's go ahead and look a bit at the Greeks. They're a little bit closer to us than the Hindus. I'm going to tonight look at Metis, a little bit briefly at Medea, and more in slides and images on the Medusa. The Medusa is probably one of the oldest Greek myths that we have. And so we have some really old images that I think as we look at can tell us some things and just give us some experiences that go beyond my words. So that's where we'll head in just a minute. Let me start with Metis. We don't know a heck of a lot about her, that she was the first wife, if you will, of Zeus. And just as Lilith disappears from Adam, Metis disappears from Zeus. And the story we're told is that Zeus is warned that if he's not careful, he will be taken over by what his wife stands for. That she carries great knowledge and great wisdom. So while she is pregnant, he decides he has to do something with her, and he devours her. He swallows her up. And what happens is that he now births their child through his head, and that becomes a female. And who becomes an image for us of wisdom? Athena is a terribly complicated figure, and we won't be going through a great deal with her tonight. I will be casting just one look at her, but there's many that we could really think about with Athena as to what's happened to her. Interesting, Athena, by Robert Graves, if you were to read what he has to say about it, he thinks that there was a time in Libya, interesting time, that the great goddess ruled supreme. And she was a tripartite goddess. And Athena was one aspect. And Medusa was another. There is speculation as to what the third was. And that what happened in the migrations is that this great and powerful goddess got torn asunder and taken up into little pieces and taken over by the Greeks and turned into the Zeus world, the Olympian world.
I want to leave Metis for the moment, though I think some of you have probably heard Jean Bowen, and she has some interesting things to say about how, what does it mean that Metis was tricked by Zeus, and where has she gone, and how do we find it? And so just for those of you who are interested, you might read more about her via Jean Bowen, or there's a new book out called To Be a Woman, which is a compendium, a very interesting compendium of essays by different, I think they're all humanists, that touch on different ways of looking at feminine goddesses and what this is about.
I'd like to just touch briefly on Medea. Tomorrow in the workshop, we'll be going more into Medea. She might be a little closer to you. Some of you may have seen Robinson Jeffers in our time has done an adaptation of Euripides, and Dame Judith Anderson used to be just a fantastic Medea. And if ever you get to see an old video of her performances, it is awesome. The nuancing of what Medea is about. Medea, you may remember, lives over on the edge of the Black Sea in a place called Colchis. Her father is a king. Her mother we don't know much about, which becomes a pattern for a lot of these dynamic goddess figures. She's known just as She Who Knows, but she disappears in the Medea tale. And Medea is very close to her father. She's known as being very powerful. She is this great princess. And along from the Greek world comes Jason, and he's on his hero's journey. He needs to get that golden fleece. And Jason meets up with Medea. Medea enables him to get what he came for. And she's quite a full spectrum. She has a cauldron that she can raise people from the dead, and she can also kill and destroy. So she carries in her abilities and her powers this duality. Well, Jason wants to take her back with him to Greece. He does. All goes well. They have some children, and everything is going fine until, forgive my irreverence, but Jason has a midlife crisis and decides that he needs to marry someone else, and he's going to leave Medea. And Medea is not to take this kindly. And we get to see in Medea's story what abandonment and rage look like from within. It is an exquisite delineation of those kinds of experiences that live inside of us, both men and women, but particularly inside women. It is a killing rage, and as some of you know with the tale, she ends up killing the woman that Jason is going to marry. She kills the woman's father. She kills her own children. I mean, it's just an extraordinary outer expression of what goes on the interior of a family. We'll be talking a little bit more about it tomorrow. But I want to go on now to Medusa. I'll tell you more about her. Medusa is very, very, very old. She's way back there in the beginning. And now this is in the Greek creation times. This is back when Gaia's the great, great, great earth goddess. And she is able to create things out of herself. You know, she can create seas, she can create mountains, she can create all kinds of things. And she creates Uranus, the sky god. So now we have sky and earth. And this goes on for two generations, and we come to Medusa. Gaia is the grandmother of Medusa. And now Medusa is our first mortal that we know of. And she lives out there way on this edge. Hesiod tells us it's on the edge of night. Think of where the edge of night might be. I mean, it's on the edge. It's where east and west meet, the light and the dark meet, right next to that thing we might call the abyss. Now, Medusa has some very curious siblings. The first set of siblings, triplets, are called the Graei. You may have heard about them. They are all gray. They have gray hair. They are three sisters that share one eye, and they share one tooth. They are three in one. And they're playing with Trinity and oneness, I mean, in a very interesting way. And the element of the eye is a very important element for the tale of Medusa as to what is going to happen with her. So, okay, here's her siblings out there. She's got this triplet set over here, and they're all gray, and nothing changes with them. And they're eternal, very mortal. And now there's Medusa with her two sisters. And these three are beautiful, exquisite, by some texts. Later on, they get to be mean and nasty and ugly. But in the beginning, they're quite glorious. And two of them are immortal. And it is Medusa who is to be human and to be mortal. And she is to be like us. And she is not to belong. There is nothing out there that she, if you will, that she can resonate with, because she's mortal and they're immortal. So we're getting this notion of the divine and the human, of the eternal and the temporal. So Medusa carries a lot. Now, from what we know, everything's going fine, presumably. And comes a time when it's a spring day, and she's out in the meadow gathering flowers. As some of you will know from Greek myths, you can probably tell something's going to happen. Whenever the maiden's out there in that spring meadow picking flowers, the underworld is getting ready. And Medusa does have some links to Persephone. She does. Medusa's out there, and it seems that, however it happens, out comes Poseidon. Now what I'd like to do is I'd like to kind of give you some images before we go on to Poseidon. Some of you may have seen this image. This is a late 16th century, 17th century painting. It's done in the form of a shield, and that will make sense when we follow further with the Medusa tale. This was done by Caravaggio, and this is in the Uffizi in Florence. And Medusa, as some of you will know, is remembered as having a head full of snakes. So I just wanted you to see this. This is who we're going to be talking about. Okay, the next slide. Now, this is the earliest image that I know of that we have. And we're talking here about 6th century B.C. And you'll notice that Medusa, on our right, is here as a centauress, one of the few times that we see a woman as a combination horse and human. You'll notice that she has something like a mask face. To our left is Perseus. We'll know more about him in a little bit. And you'll see that he's looking away. We'll understand that more, taking the blade to her neck. Hey. You're exactly right. The comment is that her hind is reminiscent of Pegasus, who is going to come. He's going to be with us down the road of nature. Yeah, that's right. This is why it's a very important image. To her right, up above, you'll see a three-legged lizard. And then the lily to her right. And these are connections to very ancient images of the goddess. Sorry? In the form of a crook. Right. Did you hear that? Yeah. Now Perseus, if you look closely, you'll see he has winged sandals. He has a little pouch that he's carrying that's going to be important in his task. What we don't see is the shield that will become part of his, that will become a very important part of his task. And he has on a helmet. And this is something called the cap of invisibility. We'll know more about that as we go down a bit more. Okay, next slide. And he's looking away. Yes. Yes. He does not make direct eye contact. Now, this is another ancient image linked to the Medusa, a running image. And here she's winged. You'll see these little headdress. Here it takes on more of a sense of a headdress. And what people like, some of you may have heard of Jane Ellen Harrison, a very interesting anthropologist who wrote some fine pieces on Themis and on early Greek religions. And it's her view that ritual precedes myth. And that when we're looking at these, we are hearing about the myth, but previous to these were ancient rituals. And that what we might suggest is that Medusa herself is linked to a very ancient moon cult ritual. And they wore, as we know it, certain kinds of masks. And so this with the headdress, with the face, the tongue that comes, that extends, the fangs, the scaring posture. It's a religion, or it's a tradition that has to do with fear and riddance, of trying to get rid of that which would threaten you. And in your making peace with that, something very important is happening to you and your interior. Going on to the next slide. Now this gives you, again, the idea of the mask. This is more a moon face. You probably can see the fangs, the tongue, tongue extended. Here you don't get so much the sense of the snakes in the head. with Kate next time? I just want you to get a sense of what these early images are like. There she is again. Now, these images are very often called the Gorgon. And the Gorgon is etymologically a lengthy word that has to do with noise. And what they think is that these masks accompany rituals where veil throwers or these noisemakers were used. And it was a way, again, of warding off evil or dealing with evil. This is a little previous to Crete and Minoan, but it's very close. So going on to the next one, please. So here comes Poseidon. Now, Poseidon, as some of you may know, is also linked to horses. There are lots of myths around him that have to do with he taking the form of a horse, and he mates with Demeter or various characters. And Robert Graves suggests that this marks a time in history when the small horse cult was being taken over by the large horse. We can think of what that might be suggesting. What I want to say about Poseidon is that he's very much a god of the sea, the great lord of the sea. You may remember that he is a sibling of Zeus, that the great Olympian god had the terrible experience of being they themselves devoured by their father. And they had quite a journey to get out from their father. And once they were freed, they were given the different powers. And Poseidon was given this power of being the lord of the sea world. And let's see the next slide. And the next. This is a fountain in Italy. Again, we'd be in Florence, and if you could see Poseidon above, this is his chariot down below, and it gives you the sense of his awesome power. Okay, now if we can have the lights on again, please. Yeah, we'll just take a... I wanted to read to you, those of you who are Rilke fans, Rilke in his elegy, in the third elegy, writes of Poseidon, "Oh, the blood's hidden guilty river god, the lord of passion, who often out of loneliness, before she could comfort him, often as if she didn't exist, raised his godhead. Oh, who knows from what depths he came streaming and incited the night to riot. Oh, that Neptune of the blood and his terrible trident. Oh, the dark wind of his chest from that twisted conch. Listen how the night carves itself out and grows hollow." You get a feeling of how he rises up from the depths. And it is Poseidon that Medusa meets out there in that meadow. And according to tradition, he takes her to the temple of Athena. And there they consummate their relationship, if that's what it is. There they are in the temple of Athena. Now Athena gets wind of this. And she will, you may remember, she is a virgin goddess. And she will not tolerate this. And she goes to Medusa, and she blasts her with this spell, or this curse, that turns her beauty into torment to a head full of snakes and this horrendous capacity to look out on the world and to turn it to stone. Now, this is a very difficult part of the myth as to what is Athena up to. And those of you who are followers of Athena will know this is not going to be the last time we hear of Athena doing something that betrays the feminine. You may remember in the last day when she votes on the side of Apollo and says that mothers have no rights whatsoever. They do not exist. That it is only the father who carries the capacity to bring life, to give life. And that woman or the female is only a receptacle. So Athena's a toughie. And I must say I've had an ongoing dialogue with her, argument with her, quarrel with her. And over time, something for me has happened that I'll share with you as we get to some images of her. Here she is. She takes on Medusa and blasts her this way. Now, some of us as women know how often we ourselves turn against other women. And particularly, this is a controversial thing to say, but I'll say it anyway, in that situation where it is a triadic one, often women will turn against each other and not deal with what the relationship to the male is. I won't go further into that right now, but that's what Athena does. I come to see Athena also very, very connected to the virgin tradition. And it has been violated in her temple. And she will not have any of this. Medusa now goes into exile, if you will. She goes back to the end of the earth, to that edge where is home. And she takes up her lonely existence. And what we know is that if anybody makes eye contact with her, if anybody happens out there and looks her straight in the eye, they will be turned to stone. They will be petrified. Because you can imagine what kind of a figure she would become. I choose to, in my work with certain kinds of depressions and certain kinds of abuse that people have suffered, I often will find, I meet the Medusa, that particularly with women, I will find a place where this person looks out with eyes that turn the world to stone. And I, as the therapist sitting there, have to be very careful that I myself don't get turned to stone. Talk a little more about this one kind of process. Back to the slide. It's taken a little longer than now. Now this is a rendering of an Athena temple. And this is in the early centuries now, AD, and you get a sense of the awesomeness that she was given. You may know that Athena is the ruling goddess of the Parthenon, that it was she who won a competition with Poseidon as to who was to become the ruling deity, if you will, of Athens. He was going to bring, what was it? I think his gift was salt water. And her gift was the olive tree. And she was chosen as the supreme ruler at that time, and here she is. okay, the next time.
There's another image of her. You may notice that there's something on her breastplate. We'll know more about that. Another sign. Now here comes Perseus. Perseus is also a Greek, and he is at a time in his young manhood where he is wanting to flee his mother. And he takes on this important task where he hears that there is this great banquet for this king, and everyone is to bring a gift to the king, but he has nothing to bring. And he says, I tell you what I'll do. I'll go and get the Medusa's head, and I will bring that back as my offering. And this is like the ultimate gift that could be given. She is the most heinous, the most dreaded, the most feared, and he's going to go and get it. Now, he finds out that he's not going to be able to do that very easily. He's going to need the help of the gods. So he goes to Athena, and she says she'll give him a shield. And he is to take that shield, and he must never, never make eye contact with Medusa. Instead, he must look into the shield, see her reflection, and cut off her head while looking at her through the shield, not direct face to face. And there's something about that that's very wise. You'll notice that the weapon he uses is suggesting even a moon-shaped weapon. The blade there. You'll notice he has the winged cap. He gets that from Hermes. Now Hermes, Jung liked to call Hermes an archetype of the unconscious. Hermes, in that way of ever shifting, changing form, being reliable and unreliable, being a thief, being a messenger, being so many things, ever changing. You count on Hermes, you don't count on Hermes. You trust, you don't trust. And it keeps us on our toes. You know, don't get too complacent in working with the unconscious. But now Hermes has given Perseus this cap that's going to veil him in invisibility, so he won't be able to be seen. And there's something about working with something that carries this much power, this much awesome power, that we have to have extraordinary capacity to get near it. Okay, the next slide. Is it close up? Okay. Now this is back from ancient magic. You just, again, you see now here, if you look closely, the Medusa is back to being kind of a masked character, a monster, and she carries in her arm a horse. The protruding tongue, the question is, what does that mean? Now, some people see it as the phallic aspect of the feminine, the masculine aspect. Some people see it as the fearsome, awesome aspect. You probably will have noticed with young children how they will at times make faces at you, stick their tongues out at you. It is indeed an image of irreverence. There's a goddess image that comes out of Bali named Ranga. Some of you may have seen her.
And she has this enormous tongue that protrudes, and in some renderings, she actually has little mirrors on the tongue. So it's an image of, what's the one I want? Not irreverence, but defying, when you are defying something, when you're daring to say no to it, you will stick your tongue out at it. So there are many ways of thinking about what that tongue is about, whether it's the phallic part, it's the part that is out to terrify, the part to say no to. It is also something that is not seen to the eye as beautiful, as receptive, as tender, as caring. It's dressed up a bit and offered as a gift from Perseus to Athena. If you could see the image better, you would notice that to the top of her head, there is a vulva shape right above the headdress, right there. It's very much incorporating a strong image of the feminine, both in its body and in its spirit. You see, right up there. So we know that there's something about Athena that seems to, Medusa, that's very connected with some aspects of the feminine. And that's, I think, right now where we just leave it for a minute. We'll take a break, get a little fresh air, and come back in, what, about 10 minutes. I was asked a question in the break that I'd like to just spend a moment or two talking about. And that's I made a comment that Jane Harrison said, ritual precedes myth. And I remember the first time I myself heard that, I thought, well, so what? What does that mean? And yet you're probably hearing more and more now about what it's like to have life without ritual. We also talk about what it's like to have life without myth. Joseph Campbell helped sensitize us to that lack. But there's also something about life without ritual. Both myth and ritual contain energies. They help us to be able to experience certain energies that we might not know what to do with otherwise. And those of you who are in deep therapies where you're working closely with the images and movements of the unconscious, know that it can be quite an awesome undertaking to work with what comes forth, to work with what breaks from within. Now, those of you who are in the Roman Catholic tradition know that there's a very, very powerful ritual in the Eucharist and in all of that the Episcopals, the Anglican Church has it too, and a lot of the Christian churches do. The Jewish faith, and the Bar Mitzvah, the Bas Mitzvah, the various things, these various rituals, as much as we may at times in our 20th century skepticism and high learning, we may look at these and say there's too much magic or whatever it is, there's something about the power of these rituals and the mystery that they contain. And I'd like to suggest that as we're dealing with the Medusa, that we are hinting back on an ancient ritual that we know very, very little about. We know her. We know it more by its shards. You notice I entitled this talk Shards of the Dreaded Feminine. Part of that's taken from the fact that I know I live in Santa Fe where there are lots and lots of shards. But I think that that is a way that we are efforting to get in touch with something. Whether it's people like Gimbutas and Rihanna Eisler with their chalice and the blade, these various probings as to what was the goddess tradition that's become much more popular now, of going back into pagan religions, going back into early myth, early fairy tales. It's as if we are back there gathering up shards. We may never know the full totality of what was back there. But we do that in our own therapies, in our own analysis. We go back and we gather up shards as to what was back there. And they may only remain shards. And we think that we're going to go back and get the full-blown past as we knew it then. Maybe we do. Often we don't. And we just get these little pieces. But they're very, very precious. And it's something, you know, when I first came to the Santa Fe area, it was quite remarkable to me to look down on that barren land and to find these little fragments of pottery. And it didn't matter that I couldn't see the whole. Just that little piece, no matter what, carried such magic for me and such mystery. It was as if you could feel the hands that once held it and once formed it. And in a way, and what we're trying to do here with Medusa is just touch this fragment. Just let, for a little bit of time, ourselves touch her, connect with her, and let our imaginations loose with her. See what it is that she evokes for us. It doesn't have to be letter perfect. It doesn't have to be what the scholars tell us, or the historians prove, or the archaeologists. It's what it means for us. And tonight when you go away, I would hope that somehow this notion of these ancient goddesses in their dreaded aspects will stir something in you that I don't know what it will mean to you, but that it will touch you in some way. Going back to that question of ritual versus precedes myth, I like to think that back there in ritual was a full body experience. The body, the mind, the spirit, the soul were all involved. And now we have some difficulty finding those kinds of rituals where they can embrace all of who we are. I wish that there were more ways for me to bring to you the Medusa so that was more ritualistic, more that your body, mind, spirit were involved. That's my limit, and so. For a minute, I'd like to tell you just a little aside here, too. I'd like to share with you how Medusa was viewed by some other folk. Medusa captured the imagination of Sigmund Freud, and you know that Freud found the Greek myths very, very important. The Oedipus myth became a cornerstone to his psychology. Those of us in the Jungian tradition build on that and see that there are even more and more and more myths. And this is what Freud had to say about our... I seem to have trouble finding where Freud is. Just a minute. He has a very strong male response to her. And I seem to do better without notes. Freud writes, "We know, too, to what a degree depreciation of women, horror of women, and a disposition to homosexuality are derived from the final conviction that women have no penis. You know, perhaps, that the mythological creation, Medusa's head, can be traced back to the same motif of fright at castration. The terror of Medusa is thus a terror of castration that is linked to the sight of something. When a boy catches sight of the female genitals, essentially those of his mother, sight of Medusa's head makes the spectator stiff with terror. Becoming stiff means an erection. Thus, in the original situation, it offers consolation to the spectator. He is still in possession of a penis, and the stiffening reassured him of the fact. So you know that term, to be scared stiff? Wonder why I couldn't find that piece of paper. Heinz Kohut, who some of you know, Heinz Kohut comes after Freud, and he's a very significant American post-Freudian who comes out with self-psychology, and a lot of Jungians are very interested in Kohut because there is a nice interface on what Kohut is doing and what Jung was writing about. Though Kohut was articulating it more from a clinical viewpoint. Let's see. Heinz Kohut writes, "Behind the head of the Medusa lies the supposedly castrated genital of the woman. Behind the dreadful genital of the woman lies the cold, unresponding, non-mirroring face of a mother or of a psychotic father who has usurped the mother's self-object functions, who is unable to provide life-sustaining acceptance for her child because she is depressed or latently schizophrenic or afflicted with some other distortion of her personality." I'd like to say a word about that. Kohut now has gone to pre-Oedipal phase of development. And we know that in the early stages, the mother aspect carries both the positive and the negative. And what we know more now is that in those early stages, the mother can come across as a very negative mother if she is, as Kohut says, depressed, if she's having mental disturbance, if she is, let's say, absent because she has to support her family. We could say that there are so many situations that can occur in the early stages when the mother world becomes internalized for the infant or the young child as terrible, negative, and dreadful, all of those things. So Kohut is touching on that. In this talk that I'm giving today, I want to address at least two levels of this. Yes, in early childhood issues, there are the experiences of what we in the Jungian frame often call the negative mother. There are those early childhood deprivations that leave very early wounds. And there is a whole approach to therapy of working on that level with those early wounds. John Bradshaw, now in popular media, is very much looking at how is it that we once again reclaim the healthy inner child. A very important movement. I want to also address that in our adult psyche, not just in its regress stages, in those early childhood stages, but in our adult stages, the dreaded feminine is a very important image for us. That she forces us, as I said in the beginning, to deal with her. We have to look within ourselves to our own resources and figure out, what does this image carry for me? What does it make me afraid of? What does it make me dread? What does it, where do I feel inadequate to deal with it? They really, these images throw us back on ourselves in a very, very definite way. In the flyer that you received about tonight's lecture, we talked a little bit about spirituality. What is the link to spirituality? I like to think that those of us who work with the psyche are ever preparing the psyche for fuller and fuller spiritual life. And a lot of our tending of the various wounds, the various glitches that we all carry, everything that we are efforting to look at and to deal with is widening and widening and widening who we are to embrace more of what we can be. And to me, that is really what our spirituality is about, no matter what religious tradition we're in. Sometimes, particularly in my own tradition of the Christian tradition, we have a tendency to only acknowledge the light and the good. And that concerns me for the inner split that that carries, that it splits off those whole parts of us that make us feel bad about ourselves, where we feel ourselves to be truly unredeemable. And these journeys to pre-Christian images allow us to re-embrace those lost parts, those parts that maybe Christianity in its early takeover had to reject. And only now can we re-embrace and reconnect with. Hope that makes... Are there any questions about that? I want to talk about another person's comment about the Medusa. I don't know if many of you have heard of Eric Neumann. I see heads nodding. And Eric Neumann, unfortunately, died very early, and so we didn't get the benefit of more of his work. But he certainly was around. He was alive and a colleague of Carl Jung's, and worked with the early. Remember The Child? He has a book called The Child. He was one of the few Jungians then who was trying to differentiate what these early stages might look like, both within us developmentally and then culturally and collectively. Eric Neumann writes about the Medusa and such images this way, just to give you a feeling for how he sees her. Among the symbols of the devouring chasm, we must count the womb in its frightening aspect. The numinous heads of the Gorgon and the Medusa, the woman with beard and phallus, and the male-eating spider. The open womb is the devouring symbol of the Uroboric mother, especially when connected with phallic symbols. Uroboric, you may know, is that very early stage imaged as the dragon that eats its own tail, or the snake that eats its own tail. So in the very earliest stages, that's an image of how we are. You know, we're closed in on ourselves. The gnashing mouth of the Medusa with its boar's tusks betrays these features most plainly, while the protruding tongue is obviously connected with the phallus. The snapping, castrating womb appears as the jaws of hell, and the serpents writhing round the Medusa's head are not personalistic pubic hairs, but aggressive phallic elements characterizing the fearful aspect of the Uroboric womb. For Neumann, The appearance of such a symbol indicates an adolescent stage of the ego, which has not yet become independent of the unconscious. What I understand Neumann to be saying here is that this kind of image, the Medusa, is right there heralding a threshold. She alerts us that we are at an important and dangerous place. We can't go back as much as we may want to. We've got to face this and go forward. And there's going to be something gained for crossing that threshold. It may not be easy, but there's something that has to happen here. And some of you may remember in seeing temples in India, how they have these horrific images on the exteriors. And we do have that in even some of our Gothic cathedrals in Europe. You'll see them. And why are they there? And that very deep wisdom, that they are there to protect that threshold and to keep out those who don't belong, those who can be scared away. So you have to have dealt with your fear to cross that threshold. And once you are across that threshold, you are in sacred space. So these kinds of images herald important thresholds. And as we try to avoid them, stay away from them, we are also depriving ourselves of acquisition of certain amount of strength in ourselves, of trust in ourselves, in our own weakness even, in our own fears. They scare the hell out of me, okay? They scare the hell out of me. Important to own them. Are there any questions about this part of it right now? Before we end our tale, let's go ahead and look at some more slides. Let's do that. Let's take a break from Freud and Kohut and Neumann. Well, now, this, of course, here we have a Athena image. You see her with her shield. It has the snake on it. You see something now on her, covering her heart. You can imagine what this image is. And this is an owl. This is more like a screech owl here, which becomes an emblem of her. What has happened is that Perseus has made his journey. He's gone out there to the edge of night with the gifts of Hermes, the gifts of invisibility, the winged cap, the winged sandals so that he can fly as he needs, with the sword and with the shield, and with a little pouch in which he can put the head. Now, of course, he's going to have a terrible time finding out where the Medusa is, and part of his journey is he's got to go to the gray eye, and he's got to con them into the information of where is she. And he figures out how to do this. He figures out that he has to time it exactly when they pass the eye onto the next person. Because remember, they share one eye and one tooth, and so he has to have this cunning timing where he catches them right when no one is sighted. And he holds them captive now where they don't have access to any kind of vision. We don't know the details of how he gets them to divulge Medusa's whereabouts, but they do. So he continues on his journey. And he finds her. In some versions she's sleeping, in some versions she's awake. What he does is he holds up the shield, he takes his lunar sickle, and seeing her reflection, he beheads her. He gathers up the head And those of you who are interested in his story will hear of many events that he does. He, with the power of the Medusa head, he's able to go and get Andromeda. He deals with Atlas. He deals with a series of different tasks, if you will. But there comes a time when he's now going to take the head to Athena. Now, the head has enormous power. It is said that the blood from the left side has the power to destroy, to kill and destroy. The blood from the right side has the power to raise from the dead and to heal. So think how close the opposites have come right here in the blood and the head of Medusa. Tremendous power. Earlier I talked about Medea. She had a cauldron, that in the cauldron came together these powers for good and for not, for positive and for negative, for life and for death. Again, we meet that motif in the Medusa, that they don't split them. They're both right there. The Medusa head is then taken and placed on Athena's breastplate. And it now is used as a protection for Athena. There, it serves what we sometimes call an apotropaic function. It wards off evil. A lot of us could do with something that protects our heart place. I like to see this connection of Medusa and Athena as a reconciliation. A reconciliation between the father's daughter that came out of her father's head and her split off part that's been way out there on the edge of existence and a very basic, elemental, chthonic kind of existence, instinctual, untamable. At this point, these two coming together into one creation. So I see Athena as a very empowering image if we see her this way. That she who was torn asunder by the changes from a goddess time to a more patriarchal tradition, if we see this more as a reconciliation, this becomes an empowering image. So let's go on. Now you can tell this is an earlier image. This is a really interesting Greek statue. I recently was sharing some of these slides with a group in Santa Fe, which is the Women's Spiritual Center. And generally, only women come to the different offerings. And this time, three men came, and a room full of women. And in the front row were many black and white habited nuns. And it was very interesting when we came to this image. Some of the women found this a very, very positive image. And a few of the women found it a very, very threatening image. And I remember one of the men in particular said that he really wouldn't want to meet up with the right arm of this Athena. If we had more time, I would love to hear what your feelings are, what your responses are to some of these images. It's too bad that we don't have that opportunity tonight. But. Okay, Kate. This was an exhibit in Tuscany, and I was very taken with this shield here. It was actually an exhibit just showing different kinds of military wear. And there I was surprised to see how often I would find a Medusa image, whether on a shield or on breastplates. She rose up again in the Renaissance as a very fascinating figure. Okay, the next one, it would just be a close-up of this. It's a pretty terrifying image, and I think a lot of us know this kind of image within ourselves. We will encounter this. And I think it's helpful for us to know that we're not alone with these kinds of images. They do exist. They do carry meaning. Going on to the next one. Next slide, Kate. And now we come to some of the good parts of how does this all turn out. Medusa, one of the best parts of the story and the redemptive parts of this is that from her body, she gives birth to two important figures. One is Creusor. We don't know so much about him. He's kind of a warrior image with a golden sword. And the other is the great mythic image, the Pegasus, the winged horse. And here you see Perseus is on his journey. Interesting, the use of the horse. He's got the Medusa head. There's her winged body. From her is emerging the Creusor. Okay, going on. Now, this is a pediment from a Corfu temple. This was a temple of Artemis, another virgin goddess. And this was, if you can see, there she is. There is the running Medusa. On her left, or on our right, is the Creusor. And difficult to make out, but there is a leg of the Pegasus on her right, but it's very difficult to see. That part's been destroyed. But you can imagine the power of this image lording over you as you enter this temple space. Okay, going on. Good. The comment was about, back in that last slide, you notice the round her waist. Kate, is it possible to go back? Yeah. The two snakes, which we know are the Caduceus, and linked to Asclepius. And in some traditions, the blood of the Medusa head is taken to Asclepius and used for healing in some of his work. So that's a good connection. Thank you. This, of course, is the Pegasus. Winged horse. How I personally like to see this is that this, when you're dealing with these kinds of interior states that the Medusa represents, whether it be certain kinds of depression, certain kinds of borderline phenomenon, certain kinds of abuse, the therapist has to be very like Perseus, really has to use the gifts given by the gods. You have to be very, very agile. You have to be very, very clever. You have to know how to work with the unconscious in a very Hermes way. You have to count on the wisdom of Athena. And God willing, and the goddess is willing, the Pegasus will be born. And the Pegasus is like that capacity to create and to imagine and to be playful, to be spontaneous. But particularly, I want to stress, for imagination. Because the Medusa, if you remember, she turns everything to stone. That means everything, you know, is paralyzed. It's lifeless. It's like dead. I mean, there's nothing spontaneous, playful, imaginative, creative about that state. That's the difficult, when you meet the Medusa, that's the difficult part of this. In my work with early wounds, often you will come up to a place like this, and it's to see how people have had to live without Pegasus energy, if you will, the sadness of that, that somehow in the early stages, the Pegasus was never given an opportunity to be born because of situations that froze or paralyzed those early creative levels of development. Going on? Okay. That's another image of the Pegasus. Jung was so taken with the Pegasus image that he carved it in the exterior of his Bollingen home. And those of you who have read his biography will remember that he had two dwellings that really matched his two personalities, as he called them. So there was his in-the-city home, where he had to be the physician, the psychiatrist, the father, the husband, da-da-da-da. Then there was his Bollingen home, down the lake, built different parts of it by himself, at different stages of his own journey. And on the exterior of the first tower, that part that he built right after his mother's death, he carved in the base this image of the Pegasus. And for him, it was very connected to contact with what he called the eternal feminine. And for him, the deepest parts of the unconscious are the eternal feminine, where he went on to say, the divine child lies waiting. And he saw the Pegasus as an image for that which enables us to contact those deepest, deepest dimensions. The next slide. This is the Pegasus with the hero Bellerophon. And Bellerophon is going to do all kinds of things, including trying to fly as high as he can and get as close to the sun as he can. He's somewhat like Icarus in that it's a great deal of inflation. And I wanted that when we are dealing with Pegasus energy, we also have to be careful about our own wants to fly as far up to the sun as we possibly can. It is very important that we remember we are mortals. And yes, we relate to this great Pegasus and the capacity for imagination, but we must beware of inflation with it. So Bellerophon and the Pegasus here are reminders of that. The next. This is a present day. This was an image that was found in a fashion magazine. And it was noted, it was said to me that there's something incurable in us that always wants to go back and find what was terrible will be beautiful and loving. And that's just something for us to know. I think that is something that lives on as a redemptive quality, that we as human beings carry the capacity to redeem that which was so terrifying, so difficult, so challenging for us, that we can somehow rework it so that it works better for us. So here's a contemporary image of the Medusa going on. Wanted to remind you from whence we began. And one last image. There she is. We've come a long way with her. And if you each were to talk about what that image means to you now, it would be probably for each one of us a different thing. But hopefully, she means a little bit more to you now than when we first began. This one is fifth century BC. Just a minute. Let me see if I can... Naples. That's where it is now. It's in Naples now. Where they found it, I'm sorry, I can't tell you. Do you hear this? The black... I'll repeat some of what's being said. It's very definitely an integrating of the opposites, the black and the white, the open and the closed. Okay. Turn the lights on, please. Way back at that, that first image we saw where she was in the... Right. That is the animal for the Medusa story. The horse. If we were to follow what Robert Graves says, he suggests that the horse is linked to early moon cult and moon goddess traditions. The horse also, those of you who have a chance to read what Jung has to say about the horse, he connects the horse also with the Great Mother. Now, why horse? You know, bear we know sometimes will be. Here I have to go back to ancient mind and just say that the horse quality, that kind of energy. Well, in fact, I'll share a story with you. That some of you may know that there are these books, these cards that are out called the medicine cards. Have you seen them? Of course they come out of Santa Fe. I mean, all kinds of things come out of there. And I wasn't there too long before somebody gave me a gift of them. And they are a look at the various animal images and what they mean in the Native American tradition. So in my preparation for coming here, yesterday morning, I thought, you know, I just think I might look at horse in the medicine cards. Don't know why, but I thought I would. And it was interesting to see how they said that the horse made such an impact on the Native American mind because all of a sudden it opened up horizons that had never been possible before. That now they could go great distances, it could link villages, it could link, you know, on and on. And the awesomeness of this that ran like the wind. They saw something about running like the wind. It doesn't quite answer why Medusa is connected with horse, but it's... So, I thought, well, now let me, in a kind of a fuzzy-headed Jungian way, pull a card that is an image, an animal image, to go with me on this journey. Kind of mixed up the cards, pulled a card, and there she was, the horse. So, the horse is with us. I'm not sure why Medusa definitely got linked up with the horse. I like to think that Robert Graves is on the right track, that it's connected with a very ancient time and has to do with moon and has to do with mystery. Did Poseidon, did he come... The question is, did Poseidon come for Medusa? Right. Right. Yes. Think of that, of what's going on. Here is the Poseidon, the god of the sea, also linked to horses. And here is the Medusa, who's going to give birth to the winged horse. So we're linking so many different elements in the meeting of the Medusa and the Poseidon. Now, the historians say that actually different cultures are coming together, and that the Pegasus is an image, is a new image, an integration image that's coming from the ancient world to now the Olympian world. Make sense? But if you think internally what's going on, of what's coming together, and definitely from the realm of the sea. Horsepower, lots of horsepower. Okay. Other questions? Yeah, Mickey. Right. Pegasus, when he's born, so the question was, what is the connection of Pegasus with the Muses? And Pegasus has a direct connection. Because Pegasus, when he's born, flies up onto this area where, close to Zeus, hits the ground with his moon... Ah, here's another connection to horse. The moon-shaped hooves. And Pegasus carves out this little place that becomes a fountain from which the Muses drink. And we will know that the Muses are very connected to inspiration, and we want to make sure that we stay on the good side of the Muses, you know.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.